Welcome to term three. A new start, it's going to be an exciting term. Big welcome to Judy, who's been away for a good few months. Yeah, where have you been? Everyone wants to know, where have you been?
You look fabulous. You must have been somewhere nice.
Okay, just to, before we start today, I did send out a broadcast. I'm not sure if it was 100% clear, so I'll just clarify. So we're going to do a one-off today, and then the way the calendar's worked out, we're not going to have a session in the next 2 weeks. Next week, because it's Tisha B'Av, yeah. It's the 9th of Av, and the week after, it so happens I'm going to be away. It's a very exciting thing we're doing for the first time in a long, long, long time. We're doing a rabbi's retreat. Like about 20 of us are going off to somewhere to a hotel to have like a two-day conference, so which I hope is going to be very exciting. I was involved in putting it together, so I hope it works out. So there won't be. So then we'll start again on the 10th of August. So we're doing today, and then taking a 2 week break, and then the 10th of August. And the 10th of August, I'm starting a new series called Soul Work: Reclaim Your Inner Self, which the byline is removing pain, guilt, and toxicity by going deeper within. And we're going to bring in an element of breathing work and some meditation, and it'll be very exciting. Which will take us all the way till the end of the term, till Rosh Hashanah, basically. Yeah, it is actually not so far off. Yeah. My wife and I were laughing the other day. As soon as we hit Tisha B'Av, we know Rosh Hashanah is around the corner. That always works. Yeah, okay. All right. But it shouldn't be a scary time. It's a good time. It's an amazing time, which we'll see in next series. We'll talk about it. Okay. So today's topic is, as I said, it's a once-off. It's called feeling gratitude or feeling grateful even when I don't want to. Now, let me just give you a bit of a background here. So we've in the past, we've spoken a lot about gratitude. But it's first of all worthwhile to revisit the concept of gratitude every so often. But what I want to do today is share some different insights that we've done before, and especially share a deeper perspective on gratitude, which is specifically born out of a very distinctly Jewish point of view, Jewish perspective. Now, gratitude is such a powerful topic because it's very interesting when you read particularly modern literature, I'm talking about psychological literature, self-help literature, and so on, every issue you read about, which means every challenge people have, every trauma, toxic experience, or negative personality issues that we all have, and then they talk about the different modes of healing, you'll always find gratitude somewhere very prominently on that list. Right? Somehow, gratitude seems to be the key. Like I'll talk about mindful living, talk about gratitude, and then every experience will have its specific healing. But gratitude seems to be very high there on the list, which is very interesting. So what I want to do is I want to begin with a kind of a good summary and some interesting ideas that comes from an article that was written by Rabbi Sacks of blessed memory. And he wrote an amazing article called The Power of Gratitude. And we'll do some insights from there, and then I'm going to take it in a deeper route. So he says, he starts with a very interesting research study in the early 1990s. One of the great medical research exercises of modern times took place, he writes. And it was known as the nun study of nuns. They took 700 American nuns, more or less, all members of the school sisters of Notre Dame or whatever in the United States. And they all agreed to allow their records to be accessed by a research team who were researching and investigating the process of aging and Alzheimer's disease and so on. Now, at the time of this research study, all the nuns were between 75 and 102. Okay. 75. When they did the study, it was older nuns, all aged between 75 and 102. But what was interesting about this study was that these nuns, when they were in their 20s, had been asked by the mother superior, whatever that is in the nun language, to write a brief autobiographical account of their life and reasons for entering their chosen path, right? So they had available their documents from when they were 20, and they were doing the research from between 75 and 102. And also what's always unique about the study is, you know, when you study people, it's very interesting because when you study a group of people in research, I'm not an expert on any research concepts, but this is a logical thing. When you study people, you have to take into account differences between the people and also the different backgrounds, different experiences, right? So everything can have a factor, everything can contribute. What's great about studying 700 nuns is they all actually have a pretty similar life, right? They started when they were 20 and all started with a similar path. Obviously, they're different, but they're kind of doing the same career, focus on the same set of values, the same experiences, same daily activities, and so on and so forth. Okay, so they did this whole study. The results, which apparently were published in 2001, came out like this, that the positive emotions, contentment, someone's seeing if you just put it off here. The positive emotions. That's okay. The positive emotions, contentment, gratitude was big on the list. Happiness, love, and hope. Right? So what they did was, they tracked the expression of positive emotions that was in their diaries from when they were 20. They had a whole system of how they can sort of decode the entries in the diary, and they could understand how it all worked. And they tracked the positive emotions, particularly the concept of gratitude, and saw in the studies later on, when these nuns were now 75, between 75 and 102, that the ones that had expressed positive emotions, things like happiness, love, hope, and gratitude, when they were young, in their diary entries, were more likely to be alive and well 60 years later. And they came out with their study that it was about a 7-year life expectancy difference. So like those positive emotions sort of added 7 years, roughly, onto the lifespan, which was quite amazing. Okay, so that was the study. So that's not completely surprising. Because it does show the power of gratitude and the power of positive emotions and the power of learning to have healthy emotions and positive emotions, not only for longevity but also for wellness. In other words, it's two things: living longer and also being more well, just even physically. But as Rabbi Sacks put it, and I've said this many times in different studies, what medicine now knows about individuals, Moses knew about nations, right? So he already talked about this. And he makes reference to something that Moses says to the Jewish people before they go into Israel. Now, you have to understand the context here, right? Moses was dealing with a nation that actually didn't do so well on gratitude during their 40 years in the desert. Right? That's the truth. If you look at the Chumash, gratitude, as he says, gratitude had not been their strong point in the desert, right? They were fed manna. They weren't lacking anything. The clouds of glory miraculously took care of them. And yet, instead of being grateful, they complained multiple times. They complained about not having water. They complained about the manna. It's not tasty enough, or it was tasty enough. They could taste, but they couldn't see the food. They wanted quails. They complained an awful lot, right? And as he says, they lacked thankfulness during the difficult times. There was in difficult times, and yet they were provided for, but they lacked their gratitude. What Moses was really worried about is that if they lacked gratitude then, that when they came to the land of Israel and settled down to a normal routine of life, they would really lack gratitude. And there's quite a strong passage, an amazing passage that he quotes, and he says like this. He says, when you've eaten your fill, Moses says to them, it's in the Pasuk in the very one of the upcoming Parashiyot actually. He says, when you go into the land of Israel and you eat your full, and you build fine houses, and your herds and flocks have multiplied, and your silver your silver and gold is also multiplied. In other words, you're going to go into the land. You're going to build careers. It was an agricultural society. You're going to have lots of animals, lots of flock. You're going to have lots of houses. You're going to build houses, proper houses, not like the tents you're living in the desert, right? And you're going to be really well settled and successful. I am worried, says Moses, that you are going to forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. And he says to them, do never ever say to yourself, after you've built all these things, my power, in Hebrew, it's a famous phrase, kochi ve'otzem yodi, which means don't say my power and the might of my own hand have gained me this wealth, because you'll lose all sense of gratitude then, right? And you'll become coarse, he says. He goes on to say, you'll become coarse, you will go astray, and you'll fall into great depths of great problematic lifestyles, right? Because Gratitude, of course, particularly from a Jewish perspective, has a lot to do with faith, right? It helps to understand that everything we have comes from God. All the blessings that we have come from God. God allows us to gain wealth. He allows us to be successful. He gives us that blessing. And we need to be grateful for that, right? We need to... It really goes down to something we spoke about last series, about not developing a sense of entitlement. When a person says, Kochi ve'otzem yodi, when a person says, it's the my power and the strength of my hands that have achieved all of this, then you want more, then greed takes over, then nothing is enough. There's always something you want more than you had. As the Talmud says, he who has 100 wants 200, he has 200 wants 400, in a negative sense, and all those in the sense of greed, right? So, as Rabbi Sack continued, this is something that Moses alluded to already there, and the power and the importance, the critical importance of the concept of gratitude. And now we know, since the publication of that Nung study, there's been much more research, and I'm sure many of you have read the research, so many modern books about it, and we know that the concept of having gratitude and developing a mindset of gratitude and expressing gratitude and feeling gratitude improves physical health, immunity against disease. Grateful people are more likely to actually be more positive. So they're more likely to do other healthy things like exercise, like go from a regular medical checkups and things like that. Now we also know, and this is I think why it's such a foundation, right? And why it's always on the list. It's always high up on the list of any healing process, right? Because there can be many toxic expressions of emotion that people go through. For example, people can be resentful. People can want to take revenge. People can be depressed. All these kind of things. What we find in the research is that gratitude minimizes all of these things. Which is understandable. Because when one has gratitude, you're less entitled, your expectations are lower. You're grateful for whatever you are given. We're grateful for the simple gifts of life. We're grateful to be alive. We're grateful to get up in the morning. We're grateful to have clothes to wear, food to eat, and so on and so forth. So obviously, especially if it's tied in with the concept of emunah, we understand that God gives us what is meant for us. God takes us down a path which is good for us. God takes us a path where we can grow from, even though sometimes it's a painful path, and so on and so forth. Then we're less worried about what people do to us. We're less worried about jealousy, what other people have. We're less worried about things that people say to us and things like that. Because we are grateful for the things that we do have. We recognize the blessings. We pinpoint the blessings. We highlight the blessings that we have. That's all part of gratitude. Learning to be positive, which means to look at the good. To identify all the blessings that we have. And we focus on those rather than focusing on the negative things that might come our way. Not that those things aren't negative, but they just don't deserve our focus because we build up that gratitude for things that we do have. So it's interesting to see and to track how being grateful is the foundation of so many other things. There's research that gratitude enhances self-respect. Again, making it less likely you'll envy others and so on and so forth. And he says the research also continues to tell us that saying thank you, just a simple thing like saying thank you, you know, enhances friendships, elicits better performance from employees and so on and so forth. Even in trauma, you know, we had a whole series on trauma. There's a study on Vietnam War veterans found that those with higher levels of gratitude suffered lower incidence of post-traumatic stress disorder, which is also fascinating. Now, we've mentioned this many, many times, but he mentioned it in his article as well, and that is the concept of gratitude in the prayer book, right in the very, very beginning of the prayer book, in two ways. The one is, first of all, Modeh Ani. That's the famous Jewish prayer when we get up in the morning. We just stop, and the first thing we do is we start our day with gratitude, by being grateful to God for being here, for having another day, for God giving us a fresh day with a refreshed soul, and so on. And secondly, we have something maybe less known called Birchat HaShachar, the morning blessings. If you look at the beginning of the Siddur, there's the morning blessings we say each morning, and it's just about such an amazing training. I mean, if we say it properly, of course, with, you know, you can have it in the Siddur, but you have to have it in your heart, not only in the prayer book, right? This is the problem often. I mean, the concept of blessings in general, brachot, is such a powerful lesson in, first of all, being mindful, and second of all, being grateful. The brachot we make on food, all those kind of things. But again, it's got to be in your heart, not only on paper. So, you know, you've got to say the words, but actually mean it. And the brachot hashachar, the morning blessings, are amazing because the morning blessings highlight simple things. Like there's a bracha that says, we bless God for malbish arumim. He clothes the naked, meaning he gives us clothes to wear. Just, I mean, All of us expect the wardrobe still to be full in the morning. You know, if it was full last night, why shouldn't it be full in the morning? But it's not like that. We have to be grateful for everything that comes away. Every day is a new day. Every day is a new blessing. So you want to ask something?
I was a blind person, and I have two friends who have been visually impaired. How do they say
who
heals the blind?
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. I mean, no, there's a blessing there on Pokeh Chivrim. God opens up the eyes of the blind and so on. So maybe we're going to now, because there's a whole explanation on that blessing where it could mean other things as well. So the simple answer to that is that, I mean, we don't know why God tests certain people and why does that. But even it says that someone who is in that position still makes the blessing because they at least have the benefit of other people's sight that can show them where to go and things like that. So I guess that's one explanation. But there are other explanations as well. The question is good. But I guess it enhances that when you do have the blessing to recognize of what kind of gift it is, right? I mean, there's blessings for all sorts of things, right? So Bishramim, it's also about waking us up in the morning, by giving us strength. There's a blessing, not from the morning blessings, although it is part of the morning blessings as well, that people say every time they go to the bathroom, right? I mean, we have the most, that's a funny thing to talk about, but it's true. We have the most complex plumbing system, like amazingly complex, which we don't think about. We only, God forbid, think about it when it goes wrong. Then we notice how complex it is, right? So this is an amazing blessing that people make when they come out. So Asher Yatzar, it's a paragraph. It helps when you learn it by heart so that you don't have to go look for a siddur each time. But all those kind of things. There's blessings before we eat. Again, same idea. Recognizing that we didn't create this. This is a gift. It's a gift from God. So there's an amazing amount of gratitude built in to the Jewish prayer and Jewish ritual and so forth. He mentioned something in the article, something I didn't know, which is actually a fascinating comment by the Eliyahu Rabbah. It's a 17th century sage. And he explains something interesting, which I've always wondered about, and he explains in the following way. So just to give you a bit of background, if you go to a service in shul, meaning when there's a minyan, right? So the custom is that, like when you pray alone, the highlight of prayer is what we call the Amidah. Amidah, halachically, is the main part of the prayer, right? Which during the week has 19 blessings, on Shabbat it has 7 blessings. It's a silent Amidah. But if you see in shul what they do is, and I'm not going to go into all the halachic background to it, in shul, there's a custom that when everyone's finished the Amidah, the chazan, the leader of the congregation, repeats the Amidah. It's called the loud Amidah, the repetition of the Amidah, right? What happens during the Amidah largely? So basically nothing. You sit and listen, right? Just the chazan says each blessing, and after each blessing you say Amen. Okay? With the exception of one place. There's one blessing where the chazan starts, and the congregation doesn't just say Amen on the previous blessing, but says a similar blessing to what the chazan is saying with a different version. It's called the blessing of Mordim. So when the chazan gets to that place, Mordim Anachnu Lach, where we thank God, then suddenly he says the blessing that's in Amidah. We say a very similar blessing at the same time that he's saying that blessing. It's the only time during the Amidah that we're not silent, and we get it, and we say it ourselves. So the Eliyahu Rabbah says an amazing insight. He says, what is the blessing of Modim? It's a blessing. The Amidah has lots of different kinds of blessings, requests, praises for God, all kinds of things. The blessing of Modim is a blessing of gratitude, where we thank God for all the beautiful things that we have each day. Right? So we have that gratitude prayer in the Amidah as well. So the Eliyahu Rabbah says, gratitude you can't delegate. The rest of the Amidah you can listen and you can answer Amen, and it's as if you're saying it yourself, and that's okay. Gratitude is something you need to do yourself. You can't delegate gratitude to someone else. Right? The chazan can say every bracha and you can say amen. When it comes to the blessing of gratitude, every person has to get up and say it again. Because there's no limit to how important it is to express gratitude all the time and to not delegate it to someone else. There's never too much of gratitude. You can always express gratitude, and gratitude is so healthy. And he ends off the article by saying what we shared in the beginning is that part of gratitude recognizes is that we are not the sole authors of what is good in our lives. In other words, it's a bit connected, he says, to removing the ego, to being content with what we have. All of these things, not being jealous and so on and so forth, all comes and is rooted in the concept of gratitude. And he makes the point that although gratitude, everyone can be gratitude, but of course, belief in God is really the foundation of what gratitude really is. Okay. Now, What I want to share with you is like this, that from a Jewish perspective, gratitude is so critical and so deep that it actually is required, and I'm not sure if required is the right word, but it's encouraged, at least, in very extreme ways. And I'll just share with you one small thing and one bigger thing. One way is something we've talked about before. In other words, what Judaism encourages us to do is not just to express gratitude. I mean, there's now things about gratitude, journals and all the different ways of expressing gratitude. But what Jewish writings emphasize is that it's not just enough to express gratitude. We have to become, in essence, grateful people. In other words, not just about expressing it to someone else once in a while. It's about our inner being one of gratefulness, of gratitude, right? And with the understanding that gratitude is not just for the benefit of the person that has done me a favor, but it's for our benefit, as we said, because it makes us more content, and it makes us more satisfied, and it makes us more healthy. The concept of becoming a grateful person and being sensitive to the concept of gratitude is that famous idea which we've mentioned before, that in Egypt, when Moses was sent to be the leader of the Jewish people and take them out of Egypt, so we know there were the 10 plagues, right? And the 10 plagues, the way it was, the 10 plagues were miracles. God performed miracles. But the way they were performed is that God asked Moses to do something physical, and then that would trigger the miracle of the plague, right? So for example, when it came to the first plague, the plague of blood, where the water turned to blood. So this was part of the process of dismantling the infrastructure, and Kabbalistically, not only the physical infrastructure, but the spiritual infrastructure of Egypt. So the first plague was the water turning to blood. And that had to happen by a special stick that was used by Moses, and he needed to smite the river Nile. And although, and each plague had that like physical, except for the last one was God himself only, but the first nine, each had something physical that would trigger the plague. Okay, most of them were administered by Moses. However, there were two of them that God says to Moses, you can't do it. Aharon HaKohen, your brother Aaron has to do it. You can't do it. Why? What were the two plagues? The first one was the first plague. Moses was not allowed to smite the river Nile. And the second one was the third plague, the plague of lice. What happened was that the ground had to be smitten, you had to take the stick and smite the ground. And then the dust of the ground on the surface all turned to lice. So it became like millions of lice, right? God says, you can't do it. Why can't you do it? So when it came to the river Nile, when Moses was a baby, there was this terrible, harsh decree by Pharaoh to throw the male borns into the river, right? Okay. When Moses was born, there was a whole story behind it. Moses was born prematurely. His mother kept him at home because the Egyptians used to keep track of when people got married and so forth. And it was now 9, so for 3 months he was at home. He was born very, very early. But then afterwards, she didn't know what to do because she was worried the Egyptians would discover him. So the famous story, Yocheved, Moses' mother takes Moses and puts him in a basket and puts him in the reeds of the river Nile. And then from that follows a whole story where Moses' sister Miriam looked on from afar and saw what was happening. And then Batya, the daughter of Pharaoh, came and found him and saved him actually, and so on and so forth. So what actually happened? For a short time, the reeds of the river Nile protected Moshe Rabbeinu. So God says, the Nile River protected you, you can't smite it. Gratitude. Now again, we've talked about this with other things. Rivers, the last time I checked, don't have feelings. But it doesn't matter. It's not about the river's feelings. It's not about saying thank you to the river. It's about becoming a grateful person. It's about being sensitive to the concept of gratefulness. In other words, if you become not just someone who's polite and says thank you or expresses gratitude when you need to, but you become in essence intrinsically a grateful person, then you shouldn't be able to smite the river Nile. In other words, because it's something that saved you, how can you smite it? Right? And the same thing with the third plague. The third plague was the plague of lice. God says, I don't want you to smite the ground to bring a plague. Why? Because there was a whole story. I don't know if you know, when Moses grew up in Pharaoh's palace and he went out and he saw his brethren in tremendous slavery, and then he saw an Egyptian beating up a Jew, and he killed the Egyptian. Some say he killed it Kabbalistically, using God's special name, whatever the case was. And then to hide the evidence, he buried the Egyptian, right? Now, without going into the story, you know, obviously it was the correct thing to do to save the other person's life because he was being beaten unnecessarily. But bottom line is, the ground helped Moses. The ground helped Moses hide the Egyptian. And therefore, God says, I don't want you to smite the root. So the whole story that follows, actually someone did see Moses and did inform him, and he got caught and miraculously was able to survive, and that's why he fled to Midian.
No, I know the story. I'm saying God didn't get angry with him.
No, because it was the correct thing to do. The Egyptian was evil and God felt it was a moral thing for Moses to do. It wasn't incorrect, which is a separate discussion why, but I mean, yeah. Okay. So that's the concept of feeling gratefulness. Okay. Now we're going to go into a very big idea. A much deeper level of gratitude. And it's a concept of feeling gratitude even when it's very hard. And even maybe when we think we shouldn't be grateful. Right? So what I want to do this is I want to share with you a Torah insight first. So I'll explain it as best I can so we can follow properly. And then translate it and apply it to sort of a modern context. And what that means to us today. And that sometimes, you know, we always have to do. You know, the Lubavitcher Rebbe would often say that whenever you share a Torah insight, even if something that seems completely irrelevant, something that happened many years ago, something that's a different context, but if it's part of Torah, it must have a lesson. Why? The word Torah in Hebrew has the same root as Hora'ah, which is a lesson. The word Torah means a lesson in life. So, I'll share with you something that is just a nice explanation or interpretation on something that happened when the Jews left Egypt. But it's such a powerful lesson, and I'm going to suggest perhaps how it can be applied nowadays in our real life experience. But let's focus on the lesson first. So, it goes in two stages. This idea firstly comes from a great Hungarian sage called the Chatam Sofer, Rav Moshe Sofer. He lived about 150 years ago, I think. Bit more maybe. And it's based on the following idea. When the Jews left Egypt, the Torah says, there's a verse in the Torah, that v'chamushim alu b'nei Yisrael, that when the Jews left Egypt, they left with arms. There's a few translations of that word, but one common translation is that they left with weapons, right? In case they'd be attacked in the desert, which happened shortly after. They should be prepared and have some sort of army mobilized. They were a young nation still then at that time. But they left with weaponry. So the Chatam Sofer asked the question. He says, it's a really strange thing. If they in fact did have weapons, then we have a different problem. That when they came to the Red Sea, right? If you look in the story of the Chumash, they turned around, they were trapped, there was the sea there. There was a whole other route to go, which they could have avoided the sea really. But they were trapped from behind because now Pharaoh and his army had decided to, they had regretted sending him out of Egypt, so they decided to pursue them. Right? Okay. So they started to panic. And there were different opinions of what to do. In fact, the Midrash says there were four opinions. Some say that's the miracle of the Exodus, that there was 3 million Jews and only four opinions. Okay. But there were four opinions. Some said, that's it, we just got to jump in the sea and commit suicide. Others said we should fight the war. Others said we should pray. Others said just let's surrender and go back to Egypt, be slaves again. And God says they're all wrong, including prayer, by the way, because the time wasn't the time to pray. It was a time to focus on the mission, where you're working towards Har Sinai. You're all wrong. And then God responds to each of the four opinions. In terms of the opinion, in terms of the perspective of we should fight a war, we should attack. Let's attack. God said, no, Hashem yilachem lachem. God will fight your war. Just you be quiet, be silent, be passive, God will fight your war. The Chatam Sofer asked the question, and he says, what's going on? They came out of Egypt fully armed. Right? Now you could say they weren't trained, but the truth is, just a couple of months later, they were in the desert, and they were attacked by the nation of Amalek. Right? In fact, no, a few weeks later, actually. They were attacked by the nation Amalek. And what did God say to Moses? Pray, but pick an army. 1,000 men from each tribe and go fight. And they did and they won the war. So why can't they do the same thing there? The Chatam Sofer says, why can't they do exactly the same thing coming out of Egypt? They have an army of Egyptians coming behind them. But they had helped themselves to a lot of the Egyptian military before they left Egypt. Right? You know, during the days of darkness, they found where everything is. When Pharaoh was desperate to send the Jews out, he gave them whatever they wanted. Right? In a moment of like, yes, go, just get out of here. And they were fully armed. Hamushim, they were fully armed. So why did God say, don't fight the war? Turn around and fight. Yes, of course, it'll be a miraculous war because God will need to help you like he did with Amalek and so on. But fight a war. Jews have fought many wars, which many of them were very hard to win and many of them were won only with miracles. Fine. But they still needed to fight. So why at that time didn't they fight? So the Chatam Sofer says an amazing thing. He says they couldn't, God did not want them to fight the Egyptians specifically. Why? Listen to this. Because they lived in Egypt for 210 years. You don't, because they lived in Egypt for 210 years. You don't fight a nation that you lived in the land for 210 years.
But they were slaves.
Yes, exactly. They were slaves. They were oppressed. They were persecuted. But they still had shelter there. They still had shelter there. And it's a hard concept. It's a very hard concept.
That's right. How do you explain Germany then?
Exactly.
That's what I'm thinking. Exactly.
Which, what do you mean, how do you explain Germany? Nazis were pure evil, but you have to understand, Nazis were different. The Nazis, the Nazis was a new regime, relatively speaking, whose sole intent was to kill Jews. Right? Right away. We're not talking about Egypt. Egypt was kept them alive for 210 years. It wasn't very nice to them. They were second-class citizens. They had to work hard. But Nazis came to power as a new regime and declared war on the Jewish people, just like Amalek did. Right? There was no... The Nazis actually didn't give them refuge. The Nazis came in and said, the intent here is not to have you live here. The intent is to actually to really kill you out. So it's very different. I know, because I shared this with a person lately and they asked me the same question. But I think it's very different because there it was about not having refuge there. There they didn't want you to exist. The Egyptians didn't mind the Jews existing as long as they work for us. Yeah. Right? As long as they work hard for us with less than positive conditions. And nevertheless, God says you have to have some level of gratitude for the fact that you had where to live for 210 years. And therefore, and I think the idea is, again, going back to not spying the River Nile, it wasn't so much because God was worried about the Egyptians. At the end of the day, the Egyptians all drowned in the sea because they were evil. It was more about it won't be good for you to fight them. Because for you to turn around and to fight a nation which gave you home for 210 years, even though it was less than desirable home, it's not good for you. It's not good for you, for your development of gratitude. Right? It's not good for your development of gratitude. Interesting insight. Now, because I'm sharing this with you, I'm going to share with you also, just to add to it, a very beautiful interpretation that was offered by the Chatam Sofer's grandson, the Ketav Sofer. And he said the following. There's a very, you know, I think I've said this to you before, that when you learn Midrash, right? In Midrashic literature, there's sometimes things we call like cryptic Midrashim. The Midrash will say something and like, we don't know what it means. So there's a, you know, on Chagim we say Hallel. You know, the Hallel is like a special praise. It comes from Tehillim, really. And one of the paragraphs of Hallel we say, by the Seder also, it talks about the splitting of the Red Sea. And it says there, Hayam Ra'a Vayanos. The sea, the ocean saw, and it fled, it split. And all the commentaries asked, what do you mean the ocean saw? What did the ocean see? It doesn't say what it saw, right? The ocean saw something and it split. Right? It became dry land. So one of the very cryptic midrashim says the following. When the Jews left Egypt, they took with them the coffin of Joseph, right? Joseph had made a pledge hundreds of years before when he died that when God eventually takes you out of Egypt, I want to be buried in Israel, which is, Joseph is buried in Shechem, the tomb of Joseph, one of the most contested sites in today's modern world, right? But anyway, he was buried there. So when they left out of Egypt, in fact, it says Al-Midrash that before they left Egypt, Moshe Rabbeinu went around and he was trying to find it. It was sunken in the Nile and the whole thing, how he found it and discovered it, and they took it out of Egypt. So they were traveling with the coffin of Joseph. In fact, the entire 40 years where they traveled, they traveled with the Aron, with the coffin of Joseph, until they came to Israel. It says the Midrash, Hayam Ra'av Yanos, the ocean saw and it split. What did it see? It saw the coffin of Yosef. What's that supposed to mean? Right? So the Ktav Sofer says an amazing thing. What do you mean the ocean saw that Yosef was there? So he says, okay, I'm splitting. So there's a, again, it's a midrashic idea, but it's a very powerful idea. Midrashic idea goes like this. The ocean didn't want to split. The ocean was created by God. Water flows. The ocean says, I'm not, my job is to flow. My job is to be water. Why should I split? And then suddenly it sees the coffin of Joseph and it's splitting. Why? So let's go all the way back to when Joseph was sent to think another biblical story. Joseph is sent all the way down to Egypt and he ends up working for Potiphar. Potiphar and his wife, one of the great ministers of Egypt. He's very successful there. And suddenly it takes a turn of events. He's working for them. They gave him a job. They employed him. They were treating him well. And then Mrs. Potiphar, Potiphar's wife, decides she likes Joseph and she tries to seduce him. And he refused and refused and refused. And then one day, there was some sort of holiday, it says, and all the household people were there. She said she's not feeling well, so she's not going. And Yosef comes to the house to do his work and she corners him. Right? Shechva Yimi. A whole story. It was very tempting. This shows you about the human struggle. Even Joseph, such a righteous person, almost succumbed. The Midrash says that he saw all of a sudden a vision of his father and he refused and he says no. Vayama'en, he refused flatly. He says, no, I can't do this. And he knows that this is getting really tricky because she's grabbing him. So it says what he did was he was wearing like a jacket, a bag, some sort of garment. He wiggles out of his garment. Vayanosachutza, and he runs outside. The problem is now she's got his garment. So Potiphar comes back. She makes up a whole story. She says, you know, because now she's angry with him. She says, you know what? Joseph came to me and he tried to play games with me. And evidence, I've got his garment. And Potiphar throws Joseph in jail. And he spends many years in jail until he comes out and interprets the dreams of the baker and the butler and Pharaoh. And he becomes the viceroy of Egypt. So the Ramban Nachmanides, one of the great sages in the, I think, 13th century, the 14th century, asks the question. He says, Joseph was a very strong guy. We know this from later Midrashim with him. Potiphar's wife grabs him. He just sort of fought with her and pushed her away and ran out, like with, leaving no evidence. Says the Ramban Nachmanides, he says, again, this concept of gratitude, Joseph could not see himself wrestling with Potiphar's wife. They were people, they were employers, they were people who gave him a job, they were treating him nicely, except for this moment. And he couldn't do that, so he decided to do it without aggression, without force. He decided to wiggle out and leave. So he says, the Ktav Sofer says, this is the story of the sea. Even though it put him into danger, right? He says, this is the story with the ocean. The ocean doesn't want to split. The ocean, figuratively speaking, has this complaint. You guys have got weapons. Fight back. You don't need to split. Fight back. Defeat the army. And you'll find a different way around. Which there was. According to the commentaries, there was a way around. And they're not fighting. They're saying shtum. God says, don't fight. There's no war. But there's an ocean there. The ocean's not budging. Says the Tehillim, Hayam Ra'a. The ocean saw. What did it saw? It saw the coffin of Yosef. Reminding the ocean that Joseph could have also fought. And he refused to do that because he wouldn't fight against someone who gave him a job. Then he realized, that's why the Jews are not fighting. Because they want to be like Yosef. They don't want to fight against the Egyptians who gave them lodging for 210 years. The ocean saw the coffin of Joseph and the ocean split. Okay, that's just a nice interpretation. Why am I sharing this with you? Because, what's the relevance? It's a nice idea. It's a good drasha for shul. On the parasha we read about Joseph, but why? Right? But you're not in shul and you're not interested in drashas, so why? So why am I giving you this drasha? Even though I think it's a beautiful interpretation, but what's the relevance? The relevance is much more important than we think it is. So listen carefully. We have the same issues that go on today, not with Potiphar's wife and not with fighting against Egyptian armies, but we have the exact same thing in all life experience. Often, people have fallouts with people, right? What happens when we have a fallout with someone? As they say in Yiddish, all of a sudden that person who might have been very good to us and done lots of good things for us suddenly becomes completely, what they call in Yiddish, completely treif. Right? that's the expression they use in Yiddish, right? About someone that's completely treif. In other words, that's it. This guy's all bad. Everything is bad. Especially today, right? So we live in a world of cancel culture. So if someone does something wrong or says something wrong, boom, he's eliminated, right? That could be a person that did something really good for us, could be something but they did something wrong, and we just don't have any sense of. And sometimes, by the way, fallouts are legitimate, right? So I'll give you a couple of examples, and I think this is a really important thing to take into account, this interpretation about the Jews not fighting back to Egypt, right? It could be someone has a job, someone comes to a new place, someone needs a job, someone needs employment, for example, and he's given a job by someone, right? And then after a couple of years, has a fallout with the boss, let's say. I'm giving a simple example. I'll give you three examples. And maybe that fallout is 100% legitimate, which means the person needs to move on. We're not beholden to anyone, right? So people move on. They start with someone, they move on. They move on for various reasons. But sometimes, division and human emotion has it that if you move on in the context of something negative that happened, suddenly that person is completely negative. We have nothing good to say about that person. On the contrary, we'll gossip about that person. We'll talk badly about that person. We'll run down that person. We'll even harm that person if the opportunity comes our way. And we forget, hold on a second. Yes, that person did something maybe really wrong to us. But he also helped us out. He did something really good. He gave me a job when I was first here. So it doesn't mean I have to be their best friend. It doesn't mean I have to work for them forever. Of course not. You go on, you have disagreements. I think I'm right, they think they're right. I move on, I go into different areas of my life. That's great. But we still have to have gratitude. We have to have gratitude at least not to be poisonous, not to be toxic about it, not to harm them in any ways, not to make it our business to gossip against them in areas where it's not relevant. I mean, there's sometimes where Lashon Hara is permitted. Where if they're going to harm someone else, for example, you protect other people, of course. But we have to have that sense even then. We can't stand the guy, and it's not the kind of guy we want to feel gratitude to. It's not the kind of guy that maybe we want to, wish an atavah to or something. But there's a sense of gratitude. He might be as bad as Egypt, but he gave you lodging, right? It's a modern day application. He gave you a space. He gave you support when you needed it. You need to show gratitude. That's one example. Another example is something that I've mentioned many times, but it's so important because I see it many times when talking to people. And it's. I'm mentioning it because there's a trend. There's a trend in a lot of, not always, but a trend in modern psychotherapy and in modern sort of healing from trauma and things like that, that people often discover and find the source of their challenge. You know, we talked about this when we talked about trauma. And very often the source of people's trauma is their parents. Legitimately so. So, what's that? No, please. Right?
It's often, our fault.
Everything. It's all our fault, exactly. Right? No, it's my parents' fault, and my kids, their parents' fault. You know how that goes, right? Right. But the problem is that you have psychotherapists, and you have sometimes people in the therapy field that actually actively tear people away from their parents in the name of your healing. So you need to feel better, and you need to do it for yourself, and therefore you need to emotionally completely disconnect from your parents. Now, this happens all the time, by the way. This is a serious thing, right? From a Jewish perspective, it is completely wrong. It doesn't mean that you don't create boundaries. It doesn't mean that your complaints are not legitimate. As I said many times, no one's a perfect parent, but that's okay. And maybe they actually did. They really maybe didn't treat you well. Maybe they didn't parent you well. But they gave birth to you. They gave you shelter. They gave you food. Put you through school. So there's no disconnecting. From a Jewish point of view, that's not correct. We talked about this once. Boundaries, yes, if you need to. Protection, yes, if you need to. But the Talmud is very clear that there is sometimes with parents that are harming or to have an ongoing relationship with parents that can be very harmful. That's sometimes a legitimate route to disconnect from them and to stay away from them. But it's absolutely even then prohibited from the laws of kibud av va'em, laws of parent, laws of honoring parents, to do anything damaging to them, to shame them, or to be disrespectful to them, right? So it's not either or nothing. You know, some people think, I either can have a full-on relationship or I have to completely disconnect. That's not true. Those are the two easy options. Sometimes the hard option is that, you know, you need to disconnect on some level because you need to create a boundary. Maybe there is a toxic relationship. Maybe it does need to be protected and be sort of cut down a little bit. But it doesn't mean that it needs to be completely. It doesn't have to be completely disconnected because that's not right. There's a sense of gratitude. Even if you think your parents are as evil as Mitzrayim, even then there's a sense of gratitude. That's what the Torah is teaching us. Even with Egypt, which seems bizarre, and I think people are a little bit uncomfortable with that because it is a very uncomfortable concept. It is bizarre that if you have a nation of Egypt who oppressed us for 210 years, we should have gratitude for them. Yeah, because something that they give you. And for that something, they deserve some level of gratitude. How much more so when it comes to people growing up with parents where often it's not as bad as people make it out to. There's no, as I said, there's nothing, you know, there's no perfect parent. All parents make mistakes. We'll make mistakes. Like parents, our kids, when they become parents, they're going to make mistakes. Maybe even bigger ones than we make. But right? That's it. We're not perfect. Human beings are not perfect. No one has training for parenting. God didn't give us a requirement for qualifications to go to get a PhD in parenting before we start parenting. If we did, the world would be long destroyed because there wouldn't be any people anymore. Right? So we just keep going. We try our best. But, okay, and sometimes we do really wrong things. And sometimes parents do really wrong things. And maybe we need the R consequences. But the complete rejection because it feels good, because it'll be good for my healing, that's a very self-centered, egocentric view. You might need to do certain things, maybe temporarily, you might need to create boundaries, but to disconnect, to be disrespectful, to completely discount any good they might have done for you is a terribly wrong thing. I think this is a perfect modern application of the lesson that Torah is telling us, that gratitude has to apply even when you don't like the person anymore, even when it's uncomfortable, even when you don't want to be grateful or you want to completely disregard anything that might have happened that's positive in the past. While we're talking about it, let's just add one more thing. I'm only mentioning this because I see this and it's just very sad. And you know, some relationships come to an end and some marriages come to an end. And that's part of life. And sometimes that's legitimate and it has to happen. But I just find that it's a very hard thing what I'm going to say because it's often very painful and extremely emotional. But what happens is when people become very emotional and full of resentment and hate, and sometimes legitimate hate sometimes, I don't mean legitimate hate because hate is never legitimate. I mean legitimate complaints and perspectives. Then people become extremely obsessed with being right rather than doing the right thing. Being right rather than being happy, right? I've just dealing with a case recently where, what should I say? They're just both crazy because I just can't get through to any of them. That they both are ruining their children, the ones they had together, right? So don't talk to them, hate them, think they're evil. But the other one is the parent of your children. So do the right thing. Like, just have that little bit of gratitude that it is the parent of your child. And work it out respectfully, amicably. Many people do it really well. It's beautiful to see when people, I mean, it's not beautiful ever to see a relationship come to an end. It's always a painful thing, but sometimes it has to. But then it's beautiful to see when they come to an end and it comes to an end properly. Without extreme hate. With that little bit of recognition that the other person is still, whether you like it or not, still the parent of your child. And therefore, to do it in a way where what's in the best interest of our child? What's in the best interest of the child we both gave birth to, right? It's a hard thing. I don't doubt that for a second. But it's still an application of this idea that you can't go to complete hate where you're just antagonistic to the person to the point where there's just hate is never good for the person anyway. And second of all, to the point where it's damaging others. It's damaging the children that you both have together. So those are three examples. So the concept is I shared with you, as I say, a drasha of how you have to have gratitude even when it's difficult, but it's not a drasha. It's a real life thing. We have this day also. We all have our Mitzrayims of our world. We all have the people in our life that we like to think of as Mitzrayim, of Egyptians, of people that are persecuted and being really, really bad to us, and sometimes correctly so. But we have to also remember that even for Mitzrayim, there has to be a little of gratitude. Which, of course, all leads into, we'll finish with this. Finish with this and a quick story if you have time. All leads into the days in the calendar we're in now. This is the period of the calendar we're in now is a time to really think about this. Because we're now in what we call the 9 days leading up to Tisha B'Av, which commemorates the destruction of the temple, both temples. But the Talmud tells us that the second temple, the one that we still in the exile from, was destroyed, and everything that happened after that came about because of sinat chinam, of baseless hatred. What does baseless hatred mean? There's nothing wrong with people disagreeing. There's nothing wrong with conflict even. There's nothing wrong with people having different paths and different ways of looking at things. But it's when it just turns into pure hate where we can see nothing good. We can't even see the humanity in another person. That's when it becomes so bad. And of course, we know the Talmud tells us about the story of Kamsa bar Kamsa, right? The story that actually ended up being the destruction of Jerusalem. I've told you before many times, but essentially it was about a guy who made a banquet and he sent his servant to invite Kamsa, who's his very, very good friend. And by mistake, he invited someone called Bar Kamsa, which is a similar name. He got the address mixed up, you know, like, and, you know, the email was the beginning, the same letters, and then the end was the wrong email, so they sent it to the wrong place. But, and Bar Kamsa rocks up, Bar Kamsa had to be an enemy of the guy, right? He was his enemy, not his friend. And he comes in, the host comes into the banquet and sees Bar Kamsa, and he says, "Get out." So the guy says, "Just don't embarrass me. I'm sorry, I didn't realize. I thought you were making up with me. I'll pay for my meal." He says, "Get out." He says, "I'll pay for half the banquet." He says, "Get out." He says, "I'll pay for the whole thing." And he says, "Out." And he ashamed him. And he was so upset that he went to the Romans and he made up a whole libel about the community. Whole thing. Anyway, the whole story, which I won't go into now because I don't have time, but it led to the destruction of Jerusalem, right? Same idea. In other words, it's that attitude that there's nothing good. He probably had a fallout with him. Okay, so you had a fallout with him. You don't have to be his friend. In fact, you don't have to invite him to your banquet. It was a mistake. He's still a human being. He has some good in him. There's something good about him. So in these days, we are taught that we have to really focus on this, about the antidote to baseless hatred is baseless love. Just to be grateful to people, to say thank you to people, to connect with people, to show gratitude, to show connection and be more connected with other people, which undoes the terrible sin of baseless hatred. And I'm just going to end with a quick story, just the power of thank you, because we started with gratitude. It's a story I heard which lately, and it took place at an event which I'm very familiar with, but I'll just tell you the story. There was a guy called, it's the power of thank you, the guy called Yosef Kabalini, I think his name is. In other words, in the early 1970s, he was a soldier in the Israeli army, and they were patrolling the Golan Heights, and his truck, his Jeep, unfortunately went over a mine, and he was very, very badly injured, and he had to have his both legs amputated. And he was very, very down, very depressed, and very angry. Like, he didn't understand his whole, you know, all the emotions. And also every situation is different, but his situation seemed like, just didn't seem to be getting support by anyone. Like, his friends would come over and visit, the story goes, and as sometimes happens, we don't know, we're very awkward, we don't know what to say to people, like, we don't know how to relate to people's tragedies. So his friends would come up, and they wouldn't look at him in the eye, and they would just, like, you know, they would, anyway, he just felt very alone and very isolated, just very, very, very abandoned kind of thing. And the story goes like this, that in 1976, there was a trip that the injured soldiers, there was a whole group of injured soldiers that made a trip to New York. The injured soldiers in Israel at the time were called Nechei Tzahal, which means the wounded of Tzahal, the wounded of the IDF. And someone suggested to them that they visit the Lubavitch Rebbe. So there was a whole thing that they asked the Rebbe, and the Rebbe said for sure. And they cleared, the Rebbe's shul is like a basement, so they cleared out the whole bottom of the basement, made access possible, wheelchairs and so on. And the Rebbe came out just to give a talk for these people. And a very unusual thing, the Rebbe actually spoke in Hebrew. The Rebbe never spoke in Hebrew, the Rebbe publicly always spoke Yiddish. He spoke Hebrew, he spoke Hebrew privately with people, but he always spoke Yiddish, that was his mother's tongue. But in this case, he spoke in, and he spoke, and this Yosef was part of the group. And the Rebbe spoke in Hebrew. And the Rebbe spoke about the importance of the body being a vehicle for the soul. And he said that when a person's, he spoke about the whole idea that when a person's body is injured, the soul is still there. In fact, the soul becomes stronger. And he spoke about sometimes God gives other ways that a person's compensated. He has other ways he can compensate even physical things that to fulfill the mission of the soul. He spoke very, very beautifully. At the end, and I've heard the recording of this, actually, is quite phenomenal. The Rebbe says, first of all, the Rebbe said, and because obviously, that means the soul of each of you are become much, much stronger. He says the custom of Jews is always to interfere and give people unsolicited advice. So he's going to also do that. And he's going to say he doesn't like the name. The Rebbe said he doesn't like the name they give him. Doesn't like the name Nechei Tzahal, injured of Tzahal. The Rebbe was very big on this, by the way. He didn't like negative things. So he said he thinks they should change the name. I don't know if they did or not, but he says he thinks they should change the name to Mitzuyanei Tzahal, the outstanding of Tzahal. Anyway, interesting thing. Then the Rebbe ended like this. He said that he wants to... I'm sorry, another time's over. Have to have another 2 minutes? Is that fair? Yeah. So he said that he wants to ask them... Just the wording was just phenomenal. He said he would be pleased, if he could please be given the honor, because the Rebbe always spoke on a top platform, that's the way he used to speak. If you could please come down and personally give each one of the soldiers a dollar to give to charity and to shake the hand. And so the Rebbe came down and he approached. I mean, it was the only time in his leadership this ever happened, because normally everyone, when he would give out things, people would go to him, right? They would line up. So he came down specially and he approached every single soldier, shaked his hand, and gave them a dollar to give to charity and a short blessing, and said something to each soldier. Later on, it was discovered he didn't say the same thing to every soldier. He said something different to each soldier, which was interesting. When he came to Yosef, he took his hand, he looked him very, very straight in the eye, and he just said, Todah Rabah, thank you. That was it. And he later on was recorded, he was interviewed, and he said that was the turning point of his life. That warmth and that sense of gratitude, I guess, thank you for your service, thank you for helping Israel, thank you for sacrificing yourself, whatever the case was. Or thank you for being here, whatever the thank you meant. I don't even know how he took it, I'm not even sure how he interpreted it. But just the thank you that was given with warmth, not just saying thank you, it's how we say thank you. The thank you and the fact that the Rebbe looked him straight in the eyes, made eye contact, connected with him and said thank you, started his journey of healing, and later on he went into business and became a successful person and so on and so forth. So the power of gratitude is great, especially in these days, the days where we live in times of division, and we live in the days of the calendar which commemorate the time of conflict and division in the times of the temple. It's a good time to have this topic and to talk about strengthening our own sense of gratitude, gratitude to God, gratitude to other people, and using it to become stronger and more healthy people. Again, just to announce, I want to just remind everyone, next 2 weeks we don't have a session, then we're starting a new session. One other announcement is that on the 24th of August, Thursday, 24th of August, we're having a very special event at Bondi Surf Club called The Journey. We did this a few years ago only for young adults. We had lots of complaints that why we didn't include older adults, so we're doing it now. It's going to be a pre-Rosh Hashanah spiritual experience. Music, meditation, a lot of l'chaim and refreshments. Please take a flyer and hope to see you there and spread it around.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful week and we'll see you in 2 weeks.